Hey guys, Hattie Boydell here on the Hattie Boydell podcast, and I am so bloody excited because I have one of my best friends here today with me, and it's so funny. You know, I always think of myself as a connector. Like my whole life, I've always connected really good people to really good people, and I feel like this podcast is an excuse to let the whole world essentially know all my best friends and how great they are. And so I've got Miss Shona Virtue here.
Hi. It's great to be here, Hattie.
This is just another excuse for me to have a good conversation. So I'm really excited about this. I'm actually going to start off by sharing, and I don't know if this is the same memory that you have, but it's definitely the memory that's embedded into my mind of how we first met.
It's a good one. It's a doozy. I'm excited to hear it from your perspective because I know what I remember.
She thinks she hit on me. I think I hit on her.
Yeah.
It's a quite an interesting one. But I remember, so I was 18. I'm pretty sure I was 18 or 19 years old. And it was in, my memory was that I was in Fitness First. And
yeah,
I was
in Fitness First.
I was walking across the gym. And I look over and I see this girl doing the splits up the wall. And then she comes down and she flips her hair back. And I'm like, who the fuck is that? And you were like, the sexiest thing I'd ever seen. And I didn't really know what to do with myself. I was like, oh my God, I have to get to know this girl. And I can't remember if I came up to you or if you came up to me. What's your memory?
I feel like I possibly may have timed that wall split really well, knowing full well that Hattie Boydell was walking the floor. And so I was like, all right, we'll just show her what we've got.
Do you want to see how limber my hips are?
I mean, it just was, you know, I had to get your attention. So I really was trying to actually muster up the courage to ask you if I could train with you.
Yes.
Yeah. So actually, I was Hattie Boydell's client.
Yes.
I know. Because I was like, how do I get to, I remember seeing you train and just being completely in awe of your strength and grace. So here's the thing, like so much maybe not so much now because of the introduction of like various different bikini competitions. I know they've been around for a long time and fitness competitions, and obviously you're the queen of those things and much more. But I think something that's really hadn't been, I guess, very on show at the time for me was this like beautiful blend of ultimate strength and also this like incredible feminine grace that you have as well. And I think you've mastered it your whole life. This isn't something that's just come off the back of like WBFF or you like training, even though I know you've trained a lot to pose well and be beautiful, but you've always had this quality. And I think that was the thing that shocked me the most. Where I was like, she's so strong. She's so powerful. And yet like, I felt like the first time I saw you, it was like slow motion. Honestly, I was like, oh my God. And so I wanted to train with you, but I also just wanted to spend time with you.
I was the same as you. I was like, you know, when you meet, I was just like, how do I get to know this person? Like, what do I have to do? Do I have to bend over? Like, what is it? No, she came to me.
I did that part. So, yeah, so then I started training with you and it was like, honestly, love at first squat.
It was. I can agree. And, you know, it's so funny. I'm so grateful, and I mean this in the best possible way. You know, the thing about that COVID did for us was it brought us back together, like really closely. And one of our best friends, Nikita, who I'm sure you guys will get to know from my podcast at some point as well, is like we started to really hang out again. And it's funny how people come in and out of our life, like just beautifully in and out. And that's kind of what our relationship has been like. And the beauty of social media is that, you know, it tricks us. We think, you know, I've watched your journey and I'm going to ask you a couple of questions really shortly, but I've watched your journey through social media when I didn't have you with me. And so it never felt like you left, because when we'd catch up, it was never like we hadn't spent time together. It was always the same. And I think that's what really good quality relationships do.
I think so too. I think being able to pick up where you left off is really important, or like not even necessarily like pick up where you left off, but it's like embracing that the person, if you've had a big period of time where you haven't spent time with each other, embracing how that person's evolved and being like open and willing to accept aspects of their character that have changed, that have grown, that have shifted. I really value that about our friendship and other friendships that I have, where it's like if we have time apart that we come back together and it's beautiful. But yeah, I would say COVID definitely, it did bring us back. Did it? Was that the time that we started hanging out again? Yeah, I thought FBC. It was like Jan. Yeah, FBC, Friday Breakfast Club, is a little thing that we created with Nikita. The
Powerpuff Girls.
The Powerpuff Girls, or what was the other one?
Sailor Moon.
Yeah, there's no brown Sailor Moon, though, yeah. I'm afraid. So I don't quite fit that. Sure there's also no brown Powerpuff Girl. We need something else. Anyway, whatever. We'll just colour them in.
We're representing.
We can colour
in. We're changing it,
exactly. So, yeah, I think that was something, FBC, we came together and started to have regular catch-ups, and it was in this sort of like real transformational time for all of us.
For all of us, yeah.
Processing past relationships. We really needed each other. Processing, relationships and work and, exactly.
Holding space in heartbreak.
No, it was a doozy.
Oh, so funny. So for those of you who do not know Shona, who is Shona? Who is she? What does she do?
Yes.
What is she about?
Oh, I forgot to come prepared with that one. That's what my laptop is. I'm going to like read my biography. No, so
my name's Shona Virtue. I'm 33.
So I have my usual spiel. I'll give you guys the usual spiel. So I'm an ex-gymnast turned yoga teacher, or actually ex-gymnast turned dancer turned yoga teacher. Personal trainer. Actually, after training with Hattie, I was like so inspired by weightlifting, so inspired by the idea of getting strong as well as being flexible, and realizing actually that Hattie was a big part of like eradicating a lot of the injuries in my body that I'd sustained, not actually from gymnastics, but more so from the hypermobility that I had. So that's what kind of got me into it. And I was from there, after I became a personal trainer, I was like, okay, this is interesting. I'm going to start to move into the space of actually nutrition. I went to start to do a nutrition degree. And when I was there, I realized that this wasn't where I wanted to be, because you can know everything there is to know about fitness, nutrition, like all of the different areas of health that we know physiologically. But ultimately, with my clients, what I realized was that like psychology was just causing whether they did or didn't take my advice, or whether they did follow what was good for them or didn't. And it wasn't necessarily just knowing what was the right thing to do, but actually knowing and doing. And that's the hard part. And so that's why I've decided to go back to uni to do a degree in psychology, to try to see if I can integrate more of the psychological concepts into mainstream health and fitness, basically.
What are some of the biggest things that you've learned during this psychology course that you've been studying? This is a big question, because you can apply it to, there's actually two now I'm thinking. It's like, what are the biggest lessons that you've learned about yourself in this psychology, during this psychology course? Because obviously we start to get to know ourselves in ways. When we start to improve our knowledge of psychology, we start to tap into ourselves. So what is some of the biggest lessons that you've learned about yourself while studying this psychology course?
Oh, another big question. I think like the thing is, I've always been interested in psychology. So I didn't think that I wanted to be a yoga teacher. I didn't think that I wanted to be a personal trainer, actually. Those things sort of happened as side careers, and then I fell in love with them. But actually, when I was very young, I was about 4 years old, and I was going through various different situations in my home life. My parents were split, and lots of different things were occurring in the home environment. And I ended up having to go to a lot of counseling, because when my parents were going through a divorce case, they both wanted custody, and so they were using school counselors to kind of analyze my emotional state, to just check in with like, okay, you know, who does she want to live with? Who do we think she has the best relationship with? So I had to go through a lot of school counseling. And this is with child psychologists. This isn't just like your school counselor. Not there's anything wrong with that, but I just mean this was with psychologists, because they would use some of the conversations, interviews in the court cases to determine who I should live with. Now, the interesting thing was, as I used to sit in these, I really have a very strong memory of sitting in my primary school kindergarten room, and I can even see the room. I can see the pictures, the paintings on the walls, and I remember this psychologist asking me to draw a picture of my life, or of what I wanted. And at the time, I was 4 years old. I looked at her and I just knew exactly what she was asking for, in the sense that I knew that she was trying to get to something else. So it was sort of like an inadvertent I guess, analysis of what I was doing. And this is a technique in psychology that I'm now learning about in uni, but it's also, it's obviously trying to get, particularly from children, you can't just say like, okay, so are you experiencing any child abuse at home, or are you, is there violence in your household? Like what? So yeah. They have to find other ways, right? And yep. So there's these more, subconscious ways to get out. So I had to draw a picture, and I just remember at 4 years old looking at her, just knowing and just thinking like, you know what? I'm going to become a psychologist and I'm going to do a better job than you. I mean, absolutely ridiculous, because like it's a fair exercise that she was asking me to do. But at the time I was like, this is ridiculous. I know what you want and I'm not going to draw what you want. Or I could just choose to draw what you want and draw us fighting. And I remember drawing some picture between like me standing in the middle and like my mum pulling one hand, my dad pulling the other, and just being like, how can you think that children are this dumb? That's what I thought. Like that we're just going to draw this picture and you're going to get an answer. So I was really eye-rolly and really cynical at 4 years old. Anyway, so this made me feel like, you know what, I want to become a psychologist. And I thought at the time I'll work with children. I still don't know exactly the field I want to work in, because there's so many interesting fields out there. But that was the journey and that was the seed that was planted. Mm. And so to come back to it now, to come back to your question, because I went on a long tangent there, I guess I don't have one profound lesson that I've had from this. It's like learning about all these theories makes you kind of reflect upon your entire life and go, oh, that's so interesting. Okay, I can use that framework to try to either heal or perhaps to, you know, look at my past relationships and see where they might have been good, where they might have been, you know, really damaging. But I think probably one of the most important lessons that I've had is that I feel like nothing is truly too damaging, at least in the context of my own life. Obviously, there are times in your life where you can experience trauma and you can experience really, really, and people have experienced really, really bad things. But psychology has shown that there is, the brain is incredibly plastic.
Neuroplasticity.
Yeah. And we can change and we can heal ourselves if we're willing to do the work, which you obviously know about. Yeah. And I know about too. And so I think that's been the most amazing thing about doing this psych degree, is just going, yep, we know all this stuff. A lot of it's fucking heavy. Oh, are you allowed to swear in this?
Yeah.
Fucking? Yeah. A lot of it's fucking heavy. A lot of it's intense. But no matter what, there is possibility for change and growth. And so that's, I would say that. But we can talk about theories, because fuck, there's a lot.
There's actually a few things as you speak, Shona, there's so many things I want to grab onto. And I guess just to piggyback on what you just said around neuroplasticity and I guess seeing things from different lenses, one of the most profound moments in my life was going, holy shit, the mind is so powerful. And even more as I've gotten older and working with Michelle, who's a neuropsych that we have in the Sports Bottle Project, going, oh my God, the nervous system. Mm-hmm. Everything is, it's all about the nervous system and it's all about your mindset. And knowing that means that we can shift. Like, we can shift if we are reactive or responsive, mm-hmm. but we have to get to know ourselves.
Yeah. And that's sometimes the hard part, right?
And that's the hard part, yeah. Because to know ourselves, we have to expose ourselves. That's what I always say. I'm like, and sometimes we don't want to expose ourselves, because comfort always wins. You know, comfort always wins, and we have to be backed into a corner to really make the changes. And that's a choice. Just like healing is a choice and suffering is a choice. Because
yeah.
You know, a lot of our suffering, and I guess I'm going to say this from my own experience, is it's in my mind. Like it hasn't actually happened externally.
Perception of the problem.
Yeah. You know, so knowing what I know now around the power of the mindset and the power of the nervous system, it makes everything feel okay.
Like almost like it's created resilience in you.
Like, I can change. Okay, once I have some space,
yeah,
I can make some changes. Once I have an awareness, I can make some changes. And yes, that's the power of psychology, because whether you think you can or you can't, that's exactly right.
That's going to be the outcome. And there's actually something really interesting that I've just started reading about. Where's my phone? It's called The Expectation Effect, and it's a book by The Expectation Effect is the name of the book, but obviously that's not it's a book, but it's also obviously a theory that's been well studied, or an effect phenomenon that's been well studied. And it's a book by David Robson. I'm just going to pull it up, because I think it's really profound. And I know we're going to talk about attachment theory, which I'm really excited about, relationships. Mm-hmm. But the reason I want to just bring up this book is that, yeah, David Robson, The Expectation Effect, How Mindset Can Transform Your Life. So it sounds sort of like some self-help book, but it's actually a science writer that's looked at all of the research on the placebo. Mm. And basically what they've – and I've only just started listening to it, and it's something – this is not the same as like The Secret, and it's not the same as like Abraham Hicks kind of like put it out there, and you know what I mean? But what's interesting – is that there are some really strong correlations to it. So while I wouldn't say that all of the New Age stuff applies, and sometimes it feels a little bit like it bypasses like reality, there are some findings in now that the empirical evidence that what we expect will be the outcome will be. So we almost create this self-fulfilling prophecy phenomenon, essentially. And they're starting to see this. Now, one type of the expectation effect is the placebo. Mm. And what they're seeing is that it's so strong that it can obviously improve health markers. So when people are given a placebo tablet, sometimes they get healthy. And so scientists were like, we need to study this because this actually has some profound stuff going on here. Mm. So yes, to come back to what you're saying is like actually whether you think you can or you can't will be the outcome. And that's starting to show up a lot empirically, like loads and loads of evidence to suggest that. And so it's like, cool. Cool. Anyway, sorry.
You mentioned that there's a lot of different theories that
yes.
you obviously are exposed to while learning psychology.
Mm.
What has been the most interesting for you?
Okay, well, you know that when you and I meet up, we mostly talk a lot about relationships.
Yes, I love talking about relationships. Holy shit.
Yes. And not just like, you know, who did this, who did that, what did he say?
No,
what
it's all
say? It's more like
it's under.
Yeah, it's under all of that. And also, yes, we relate it back to ourselves, but also looking at like just the quality of relationships in general.
Mm.
We know that human beings need good quality relationships for health. So people that have good quality relationships have better health outcomes, like to the degree of like if you have bad quality relationships, people that have like just not many or very reduced in quality, not so much quantity, but quality, will die earlier, will suffer from like high rates of like just morbidity in general, right? Particularly with cancer and cardiovascular disease.
Mm-hmm.
So correlation isn't causation, but we can, you know, there's a lot of studies to show this. And also like, okay, if you're one of those people that are like, I don't care about studies, I just know what I experience, you probably know that when your relationships are bad, you feel it in your body and it starts to, yeah, okay.
Oh my gosh, Jonah.
For the listeners at home, they can't see us. Hattie is like wriggling.
On the floor.
Yeah, basically she's like wriggling in like just remembered pain. And I have so much of that, we both do. And how sick it can make you. It impacts your lifts. Right?
It is the bottleneck to my existence.
So intense.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. Heartbreak. And actually they know that it can physically – there is such a thing as like physical heartbreak, as in they've seen what it does physiologically. Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
My poor little heart had to put it together.
I know. You had to put it back together.
Now it's whole and full.
Yeah.
Just so robust.
Big and sexy.
Yes.
So robust. She's
got a hot heart. I've got a hot heart, ladies and gentlemen.
Yeah, exactly. So, sorry, to come back to the original point, relationships. We love talking about relationships, and the quality of our relationships really determines like the outcome of our physical health. So this is why I think it's really important to me and to you too. And so probably the most profound on my life and in my relationships was discovering attachment theory,
mm-hmm.
created by John Bowlby in the 50s and 60s. John Bowlby, amazing psychologist and psychoanalyst, was originally studying, like was really quite obsessed with geese. Okay. Initially. So he was really interested in animals and in also how like they developed. Obviously he was interested in other things because he's a psychologist and a psychoanalyst, but essentially was also interested in the concept of like attachment, right? Mm-hmm. How people attach. And at the time, the dominant theory, I think, was based on the fact that children, yes, they attached to their caregiver, but the reason they attached was because of food. So they thought that it was originally just like a food thing. It was like, or just like the way that like a dog will attach based on like if you're giving it food, right? Yeah. But humans are more complicated than that. We're not just food motivated. And actually dogs aren't just food motivated either. So it's not just that. But with geese, for example, and this is what John Bowlby was also studying, was that obviously when geese and ducks hatch, whoever they're around initially, they kind of imprint on. Have you heard of imprinting?
No.
Okay, so imprinting is basically like, so you could like imprint a geese to a dog by just having it hatch around the dog.
Yeah, go on.
Wild. Hattie's mum's in the room with us and she's like, you're like, I'm going to get some geese and make them attached to the dog. Yeah, so it's called imprinting and it's really common with birds, right? Which is why you have to be really careful. Like if you touch a bird when it first comes out, it then might not attach to its mother.
Oh, shivers.
Yeah, yeah, you're like, oh. Are you crying?
My little chicken. So, I'm its new mum.
So,
wish I could do that with puppies.
Yeah, I know. Bless.
Love me.
Well, so humans don't imprint, but there is a, and this is what John Bowlby found, is that there is a critical period. And this critical period is where we form attachments with a primary caregiver. Now, it doesn't have to be a mum, doesn't have to even be a biological parent. It can be anyone that's a caregiver at the time that provides us with a sense of attachment and security. So, it's a fucking big theory and I'm trying to like in my brain before coming here, I was like, I really want to like try to make sure that I don't kind of bombard you guys with like an overload. There's some really great resources to read if you're interested and I would just highly recommend becoming familiar with it. Everyone, I actually think, and I will advocate for this as soon as I'm a psychologist, getting this taught in schools at a young age, like really getting people to understand it because it's a framework through which not so much that you can, okay, for lack of a better word, attach to, but at least so that you can understand yourself, understand your triggers, and then act accordingly.
And is that in relationship?
This is in relationships. Yeah. So basically what John Bowlby found was that there's this critical period through which we attach to our primary caregiver and that the quality of this attachment determines not just how we are and behave as a child, but how we will behave later as an adult in our romantic relationships primarily, but also we can do it in friendships and things like that, but primarily in our romantic relationships, which is really annoying, basically, because if by any chance you happen to be an insecure attachment style, which is, for the record, roughly about 40% of the population, based on the number of studies that like kind of drawn this conclusion. And the numbers vary sometimes between like 30 and 40% of insecurely attached people. So let me just run you down the cliff notes of like this thing.
Okay. How do we know?
Totally. So there's two types of attachments, two main types. There's secure and there's insecure.
Yep.
Okay. A securely attached child will usually, and this actually comes off the back of a study by Mary Ainsworth, who's another American psychologist John Bowlby's British. Mary Ainsworth from America, and she did an experiment called the Strange Situation, which I can talk about later. But basically it was analyzing babies and what would happen if like they were in a room with their parent playing. I'm just going to tell you about it now, actually. So just pause. I will get back to the point. Just hang on because it's good to understand this background. You got a mother, baby, toddler kind of age playing in a room. And obviously Mary Ainsworth and other researchers are observing. And what they're observing is like how the baby interacts with the mother, but also they're observing what happens when the mother leaves the baby to continue to play. Then they bring a stranger in. They watch the baby behave. Then the stranger leaves and the mother returns and they watch like what happens when the mother returns. Obviously when the mother leaves, most children will always react with like a, what the hell? Like, where are you? And so there'll be some kind of crying or there'll be some kind of like protesting behavior. Now, when the stranger walks in, it's the same sort of thing. They're a bit like this is uncomfortable. Did you like my impression there? and then they feel, you know, not all of them will cry, but some of them will just be kind of like, what the hell is going on? Anyway, the stranger leaves, the mother returns, or the primary caregiver, let's say, because sometimes it's a father in some cases, but they return and what they're observing is like how the baby or the child reacts when the mother returns. So in secure relationships, often the child will cry, yep, but when the mother returns, they feel comforted, they feel safe, and they're like, okay, cool, and they can continue playing. In an insecurely attached child, the expression is normally, and there's two different ways. In an anxious attachment style or anxious ambivalent, what will happen is the child will be really needy, really clingy and really upset with the parent and will demonstrate this in various different ways, right? Mm. Like it might be crying, but it might also be like, I'm kind of pissed off at you. Mm. Now, in an avoidant situation, when the child is avoidant, this is another type of insecure attachment style, the mother will come back in and the baby will ignore the mother and be like, you just left. And he's like,
oh my God, I'm going to observe this in so many children now when I'm outside.
No, it's super interesting.
Someone's going to touch them.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, exactly. No, you totally could. Yeah. So it's like they would be kind of like, almost like, I knew you were going to leave. I know that I'm never, you know, I know I'm unworthy of love. And so whatever. Mm-hmm. And so like, it's a sense of ignoring and detachment. And so the reason I'm telling you this backstory is that, again, this can kind
show
of
up in our adult show up in our adult relationships.
Exactly, exactly. In different, obviously different ways, but similarly. Okay, so we have it. Let's come back to the thing. So we've got two main styles, secure, which we know what happens with secure babies. Yeah. They manage their emotions much better. Mm. Doesn't mean that they don't experience insecurities or, you know, like any normal vulnerable human may experience. It's just more that they can self-regulate a little bit better.
Yeah.
An insecurely attached person will have two main, or actually there's actually three, and I'll talk you through them. There's ambivalent or anxious, there's avoidant, mm-hmm. and then there's one called disorganized. And disorganized is a manifestation of usually highly traumatic circumstances, mm-hmm. like really heavy child abuse. Yeah. And so there's a real like extreme version of both. They might present both sides. Yeah. They might be really, really, really avoidant and really, really, really anxious. And so they'll have both. So it's sometimes hard to detect unless you are looking at it. And they often have like high correlation with, you know, anxiety, depression and borderline personality disorder as well. So that's like another side of things. But some people fit within the category of ambivalent or anxious attached mm. and avoidant. Now, how do these manifest in our adult relationships? Is that what you want to
know? Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So you can do this test online, by the way. You can go on, jump on, and there's great books and great resources, which I'll share with you. But usually an avoidant will be the type. Okay. Before I say this, the most ironic thing about both of these is that in relationships, they both fundamentally feel as though they're unworthy of love. And therefore, one child will, or one person, let's say one adult, will act out in a way that tries to get reassurance, the other pushes it away, okay? Mm-hmm. Avoidance push away love because they feel that that is safer, because at their core they still feel unworthy of love, that mm-hmm. love leaves. Insecure, anxious people have the same fundamental belief as avoidance. That's the irony of the whole situation. They have the same fundamental belief, abandonment. Mm. They just go about getting the love in a different way. They go about getting it in with protesting behavior, with neediness, with constant need for reassurance.
Mm. Is that so? Sorry to interrupt there.
No, but go.
So it's like they want constant need of reassurance, yet they don't believe it.
Yet they don't believe it. They never believe it. Doesn't matter how much love you give, they will, at their core, unless they come to address it, don't truly believe that they deserve it. Same with an avoidant. That's the thing that I'm like, oh, this is so heartbreaking. Like these two people who will get into very tumultuous relationships because you can imagine, okay, so let's just like kind of bring it to a scenario here. Avoidance and anxious will usually come together, and it starts with a really passionate, fiery romance and it's the fucking best. Okay.
Speaking of experience, it's been amazing.
Okay. Honestly, the sex is so good. And you're just like, oh, because.
Lead, no, don't.
100%. 100%. Because guess what? Like,
oh, no, you don't.
Like, desire, truly, yeah. Desire needs that lack of safety for it to really be like hot initially, yeah. At least, right? Initially, yeah. We sort of feel like, oh, this uncertainty creates some kind of sexiness. Love is safe. Maybe it's not as sexy, right? We can come to a place in our relationships where it is, and we have both, and that's beautiful. I feel like you're in that place, right? You have like desire for each other, and yet you also have like a sense of safety and honesty, and that's like ultimate goal, right? But what can be difficult, particularly initially in a relationship, is you don't have the love, but you have a lot of uncertainty, and that makes things really sexy and really hot.
So God, uncertainty kills me. I'm like, uncertainty debilitates me.
Yeah, maybe now you're in a slightly more evolved state, but perhaps initially There was like, it was like, because you know what it does? It triggers your nervous system.
Yes.
So you start, so here's what's really interesting, right? You start, and this is huge because we see it in media all the time. Like we see it in like movies and songs and everything. We've mistaken, this is funny, that highly activated nervous system, that sympathetic state where we're like fight or flight mode for love. And it's not.
No, it is not.
It's not.
Love is steady. You know, I see about love, like love is steady. She is open. She is, and I say it as a feminine for some reason, but
that's fine.
She's forgiving and she's open and she's curious. And I think something that, oh God, Shona, I've learned so much in relationship, in particular my biggest relationship and the breakdown of it and just growing up and learning more about myself and learning it, like I had a lot of attachment in past relationships, and something that I did that was really dangerous.
Wait, when you say you had attachment, do you mean like
I had anxious attachment. Okay. Oh my God. Yeah. So bad. And I really made sure, like this time around, I'm like, okay, like what's going on for me? Mm-hmm. And, I've learned a lot in this relationship. Like it's, you know, the thing that we think relationship is, isn't always that. And
okay, wait, can you elaborate?
And what I mean by that is like this thing that it's perfect, and that, you know, if you think about it, most of the time, well, in this relationship, this new relationship, I didn't know anything about this person before I met them, you know? And so we only knew like what we saw on social media.
So is that different to your previous long-term relationship? Like the really long one? Like did you know each other before and then come together?
I guess we didn't, but I was only 20 years old.
Yeah, and social media wasn't a thing as well.
Social media wasn't a thing. And I was 20 years old, and the danger that I did in that relationship was that I put this person on a pedestal.
Mm.
So I was always below them.
Yeah, it is dangerous. Yep.
I definitely had an anxious attachment to that person. Not saying there wasn't love in there. There was, there was a lot of love in there, but there was also breaking of my own boundaries in there.
Did you find that he was avoidant? Because you guys were together for a long time. Okay, that's interesting. Okay.
Yes. Okay. Yeah, like, you know, I guess ebb and flow of both and this time round it's like.
But I will say, wait, not to interrupt you, I want to hear this. The interesting thing about avoidant and anxious attached people, relationships, is that there is an ebb and flow, and that's what makes them so addictive. And that's often why they can last a long time, but it's like nervous system gets spiked. Then you come together, then the feeling. Mm. Anyway, so continue. Yeah, yeah.
Look, and, you know, then in 9 years there was so much, you know, there was so many highs and lows, of course, what 9 years would bring you. And I was so young and I really didn't know a lot about myself like I do now.
Mm.
And we get the lessons that we need in life, no matter how difficult they might be. And I guess something that I really wanted to be conscious of in this new relationship was I didn't want to put this person on a pedestal. Mm. In fact, what I love about this relationship now is like I see this person eye to eye. I'm not above you. I'm not below you. You know, I'm here with you. We're eye to eye. Speak your needs. Share your boundaries. Like we're still in our first year. We still really are getting to know ourselves.
Mm.
And the beauty of being older, because I'm much older than him, is like I've had to learn a lot about myself in really difficult situations.
Yeah, that's the best way to learn.
It's the best and it's the worst, but it's the best.
Yeah.
And, one of the reasons I love talking about relationship is because it's not surface level. Mm. It's not he said, she said. There's a reason for it. The nervous system, our upbringing, how we've grown up, our environment, relationship with parents. And the beauty of knowing and getting to know yourself is you get to be able to shift yourself.
Yeah, absolutely. It's powerful. It's powerful shit. We've been through some intense ones. So yes, so this is the thing with attachment theory. It kind of explains a lot of these tumultuous circumstances by which, you will find yourself in if you are attracted to and avoidant. Now, like I said, there's tests that you can do and you can do them online. Just type in like attachment quiz. There's a great book called Attachment by, oh my God, it's so funny. I've said the title of this book so many times because I've done a lot of talks about it and I've shared about it a lot. So I'm just going to pull it up while we're chatting. But I think the thing that I guess the biggest takeaway for attachment theory is sort of knowing what your triggers are. Oh yeah, Dr. Amir Levine and Rachel Heller. So really, 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 if there's one book that I would say to kind of dive into it, it's that one because it makes it a little bit more applicable, whereas some of the other books are a little bit more like the science of attachment theory or the history, and those are amazing if you want to be a psychologist or you're looking to get into that space, counselling, whatever, then, yeah, I would go deeper even more. But this first one is really amazing for actually understanding how you might be able to apply it to your own life, and it has, like, really great case studies that are like, okay, Jessica found in her first blah, 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 yeah. You know, like she just couldn't find – anyway, so essentially it looks at this and it looks at, like, real-life situations, real-life occurrences. So here's, like – it's funny because, I mean, I've known you for so long. What is it? Like nearly 9 years.
No, longer than that. I met you when I was 18.
Fuck, dude. That's a long time. How old are you now?
33. 23? Yeah, I'm 23.
Babe. Yeah, okay. So a long time. So
I'm Benjamin Button.
You are.
I'm going backwards.
She is. Boobs are getting bigger. Face is getting younger.
How do you do it?
Babe,
how do you do it?
What's in the water up there? So you look fucking amazing. Every time I'm around, it's just like, but also I think it's a lot to do with your like inner glow. It's your inner radiance and just the way that it's blinding. For anyone listening, it's blinding. Right? I have to look away sometimes. It's true. And I'm sorry to be so gushy on a podcast, but like, honestly, I have, maybe it's not so interesting for someone to hear and be like, okay, shut up. Can you just go back to attachment theory and talk about relationships? We will. I just really have to say, because I think this is a quality that I certainly as a woman have found inspiring in Hattie. She's not paying me to say this, by the way. I'm just gushing, but
I'm blushing.
But something that Hattie has always had as a characteristic, I know I'm coming back to this because I kind of already said this at the beginning, but I think it's something that's like maybe still missing in society that I misconstrued for a long time. So for a long time, I thought that the only way to be a strong woman was to emulate being a man. Honestly, like I really felt like I had to get like in order to be strong, I only associated strength with men. That was like my own inner stuff that I had to work through over the course of my years. But again, this is why I've always found you really a really inspiring friend in my life, and not just friend but also role model, is because you embody physical strength, a sense of like incredible willpower to push through various different things that have like challenged you in your life. And yet the whole time, not only do I think that you haven't come out a cynic, but also you've come out with this – the whole way through, in fact, you've held this like beautiful elegance.
Thanks.
Honestly. And it's one of those things that I think that like we can accept in our society that like being a strong woman doesn't mean that we have to – sorry, being a woman doesn't mean that we have to accept being frail. It also doesn't mean that we have to emulate necessarily being a man. We can have these both qualities – beautiful feminine strength. And I think that, I don't know, I just don't know how you do it. I just don't know how
I think
it.
You do the same thing.
Yeah, but I feel like I thank you. But I also think that there's a part of me that's like kind of often I go through phases where I'm like in a real boy phase. Mm. And so like so much of my martial art journey has been about actually trying to like emancipate some kind of strength through fighting. And it's been really beneficial for me, but I had this realization about jiu-jitsu recently that was like, am I doing this because actually deep down I feel weak?
Hmm.
So like, it's a funny one.
Can you dive into that?
Yeah. So it's basically, and this is not for everyone doing jiu-jitsu, and I will go back to it.
This is just your experience.
This is just my experience right now. So I really want to say that because I really think jiu-jitsu is amazing for women and just learning martial arts in general. But for me, it started to become this thing where it was like I became addicted to the idea of feeling more powerful than other people. So it was like I was going there in order to feel a sense of power, and particularly, and this is a real deep dive and, again, probably an overshare.
We love oversharing.
When I came to jiu-jitsu, I was in a place where I felt very vulnerable to men. And I felt vulnerable in the sense that I really put them on a pedestal and thought that they were better than me and better than women in general. Okay, so possibly some internalized misogyny there, but I don't even like that word because it's not like I intrinsically felt like I hated women. It was just more that I thought men were better. There's a sound clip for you. Anyway, so basically, it's funny how these things can subconsciously manifest or kind of manifest out in your life, and you're like, holy shit. And this, again, psychology is so powerful when we start to ask deeper questions of ourselves. But what I started to realize is that I didn't like rolling with women. I didn't want to try and feel more powerful than another woman. I didn't care. It wasn't interesting to me to fight women. In fact, I was like, God, I love you guys. Can we not fight? What I wanted to do
was— Can I help you?
Yeah, exactly. I was like, oh, this is just like a nice warm— Let's just stay in guard and we'll just stay inside control here. That's, for the record, that's when like someone's on top of you and I'm like, we'll just hug. But basically, no, I'm not creepy like that. I am, but you in are. That case, I wasn't. Yeah, if I was doing it with a hattie, I'd be such a creep. But basically— I realized that I wanted to roll with men and I really wanted to roll with them. And it's because I really wanted to feel more powerful than them. So I became addicted at the idea of beating them.
Mm-hmm.
So, and not having them beat me. So in jiu-jitsu, you obviously tap out before you actually experience an injury. The idea is to tap out before you experience that. And so it's this constant game of like, I'm going to put you in a vulnerable position and you're going to try and escape that vulnerable position, essentially, right? Back and forth. This is not the game of jiu-jitsu, but this is what happens, okay? So someone might have you in a position where your joints are in, you know, a compromising position. That's the word. Thank you. Compromising position. They may break unless you either A, escape, or B, tap, okay? And so obviously if you tap, that person wins. If you don't, then, and you manage to get out of it, well, if you don't and you don't get out of it, obviously your joints break. If not, you get out of it and there's this kind of little dopamine hit you get because you're like, oh, yeah, see, motherfucker?
You see it in her face right now.
Yeah, exactly.
She was there in that moment.
So I was in it. And so it feels good. And then you get addicted to the next, to the next, to the next. But again, I didn't want to do this with women. I only wanted to do it with men. And I started to realize that the reason behind this was because I wanted to feel powerful over men because I didn't feel powerful over them in my day-to-day life.
Interesting.
Because I felt like I was being taken advantage of. I was being, you know, I was not honoring my own boundaries, yeah. Realistically. It's not that they necessarily intentionally tried to manipulate me. Takes two to tango. I was allowing that manipulation. And so in jiu-jitsu, I turned to when I felt particularly vulnerable in my relationships.
Mm-hmm.
And that's fine temporarily, but it's not really getting to the core. So I was getting great at jiu-jitsu. I was getting really fucking heartbroken everywhere else, okay, aww, time and time again. And so the more heartbroken I was getting, the more I was putting time into jiu-jitsu to take my mind off it.
I think I know. I know exactly where you were at.
You were there. This is FBC 101. And I was just going deeper and deeper into it. And I wasn't finding the answers there, obviously. And anyway, so long story short, what I've realized is that I'm taking a break from it just to make sure that when I do come back to it, I'm coming back to it for the right reasons. Mm. And I feel good because I'm in a great relationship and I am in an honest relationship. And that honesty and that safety has allowed me to then explore who I am. And this comes back to the notion of attachment theory, is that securely attached children and securely attached adults need to have a secure base through which to explore the world. And they know this, right, through the fucking rigorous studies that they've done on it. And so in order for you to actually feel like you want to get out and explore and really thrive as a person, you need to have a safe relationship.
Yes.
And if you don't have a safe relationship, you're going to be constantly fixated on it and you're going to find these ways to try to assert yourself. Now, in the case of an avoidant, because I'm talking very much through the lens of an anxiously attached person that was constantly needing reassurance, that reassurance was never met with safety. I always just, and you know, it's still, I have to say, it still resides in me. And I just, because of attachment theory, I know that I can calm it down because I'm like, oh, this is just my insecure aspect coming through. What does the evidence truly say? Would this, and this is actually a good friend of mine, Tally, who is a psychotherapist in London, she introduced me to attachment theory actually. And she says, Shona, would this evidence hold up in court? So when I wouldn't get a text back or when I wouldn't, you know, when someone was taking too long to reply to me or whatever it might have been, or I say, oh, you know, like he gave me a funny glance, Tally, I think he's going to leave. And so she would say, okay, Shona, would this evidence hold up in the court of law? And if it doesn't, then you can just kind of go, okay, I have to just sit with this feeling of anxiety until I actually have the evidence to suggest otherwise. Mm. So anyway, that was a fucking long tangent.
No, sorry. I thought that was fabulous. And I think, you know, I guess, like I said before, most of our suffering is in story, the stories that we create around things. And our state creates our story. So the thing, if you don't have a safe primary attachment or a safe relationship, your state is going to recognize that. And that's a really turbulent experience to have. Like, I always think about the repair system, and I'm so grateful that Michelle taught me about the repair system, and I apply that to relationship, and I apply that to relationship with self. Mm. So I think, like, how do I repair this breakdown that I've had internally with myself or externally with a partner? And I think that, you know, even going to back to attachment theory and getting to know ourselves, like, what I want to say before was when we start to learn about these things and then we start to name them for ourselves, it's not to label that as if that's always fixed. Don't use it as a stick, or I'm not going to tell you not what to do, but I'm going to say practice, you know, trying not to label yourself as a stick, and know that with knowledge and with awareness and resources, you can shift the way you are. Like, as you said, it's like, oh, would this story hold up in court? If it's a no, well, then maybe I just have to sit and maybe challenge this discomfort of this story. Is it really true?
Yep.
What is the true evidence? What would it mean to let it go? Because it's like, what would it mean to hold it? And what would it mean to let it go? And I always ask myself that. I'm like, what am I gaining from believing this story that may or may not be true? And what can I gain by letting it go?
Huge.
And that's been a real game changer, because just like anyone else, like, I experience jealousy, I experience insecurity, I've experienced tremendous heartbreak and shame and guilt and breakdown of friendships. And it's like, how long do you want to hold on to that?
Yep.
And what do we want to make it mean?
Yeah.
And we have the ability to change story. We have the ability to change state. We have the ability to make our own choices. And I always come back to radically responsible, being radically responsible for ourselves, our words, actions, thoughts, and those that we choose to keep. And I think when we can start to really tune into ourselves and go, well, how do I, if things are constantly showing up in our life, what is the common denominator? And unfortunately, it's always ourselves. And that's really hard sometimes. Mm. You know, if you're choosing the same, what feels like the same friendships that have the same repeating patterns, well, you got to get to know yourself to go, well, what am I looking in those? Why am I still searching for the same things in other people? Maybe I need to create it for myself so that I feel that whole, and then everything else is a compliment. Or I start to look for different qualities in people that actually suit the qualities that I have.
Yeah, totally.
Like, I'm attracted to people who are like me.
Yep. Yep.
That's like, I feel like I'm dating myself with my current partner. I'm like, whoa, you're so awesome. Is that you, Hattie, in a male version? Hey, why are you way more handsome than me? Like, but even my friends, I look at my friends, I'm like, I love them because we have similar qualities.
Yes.
Like, you know, there are things that I don't think, I mean, I look at you and I'm like, oh, she's so amazing. I wish I was like that. I wish I was like that. But maybe in parts of my life I am.
Yeah,
you know, you're
totally
the same.
We it's have like, so many similarities.
And I think, you know, that's where we have to tune in and go, well, what's the common, if things are constantly breaking down or patterns seem to be repeating, we have to start to change our own patterns.
Yeah.
And if I behaved the way I was when I was 16, one, I'd be dead. Like, I was really not in a good way then. But also, like, even the relationships I was around, and if I think back to my first ever relationships, they were so surface level.
Mm.
Like, I really just followed this person around like a puppy dog.
Yeah.
I had no, real idolization. Whereas now I'm like, I want to know everything about you.
Yeah.
And I want you to challenge me, and I want you to hold me to a higher standard, just like I'm going to do to you.
Yes.
Like, talk to me about things that are challenging for you and that I'm challenging you by. Like, that's what I want. I want to, I thought to myself, and this is something we can ask ourselves, would you rather live life knowing nothing about yourself or everything about yourself? And the same thing with your partner. Would you rather be with a partner who you knew nothing about because that felt safe? Or would you rather know everything about them, even the parts that are challenging for you? Well, I'd rather know that and I can work with that.
Yeah.
Give me the challenge and I'll work with it, you know?
Yeah. And it's true. I mean, sometimes often the things that we see in other people that we dislike are because they either exist within ourselves or they're a part of ourselves that we don't like.
Okay. Right? I'm so glad you named that. Okay. I've done Tony Robbins and
– Have you?
I've done Tony Robbins date, I think, a date with Destiny and have something you? Else. Yeah, I did them years ago and – I had Amazing. Some pretty big breakthroughs in those moments. Mm. And, you know, there was one exercise that we did and I'll never forget it because it was the one that I thought this is so – it was like a slap in the face for me. And it was like, all right, write down all the people that you don't like. And I was like, oh, I don't really not like anyone. And then and my partner at the time's like, Hattie, there's someone that you don't like. And I was like, okay, let's be honest. I'll write them down. Okay. What are the qualities of those people that you don't like? Oh, yeah. Okay, I can do that. Yep. Yeah, I really don't like that. Okay, cool. Next part was write down the people that you love. Oh, this is easy. It was like a list that went forever. And then it was like, all right, write down all the qualities. Oh, yes, this is this. And then he was like, all right, look at that paper. The qualities that you dislike in those other people that you don't like, you have those qualities. And at that time in my life, I did. I had those qualities. And I was like, fuck. Oh, wow. And it's so, you know, we learn these little lessons and some lessons just sit in the back of the mind and they come up and you go, oh, yeah. And, you know, it's true. No one's a perfect human being. We all experience, like, there's been times where I've lied to someone at the expense, like, to save myself.
Yes.
You know, if I think about safety always wins and it's not safety of others, it's safety of us. And that's what I always think, like, under pressure, like we fall to the level of our systems and that's our nervous systems. And our nervous system is always trying to keep us safe.
Yeah.
And it will do things and say things at the expense of maybe mistrusting our true self, but not to be at the expense of a relationship that we're trying to keep.
Yeah.
You know, from behaviors that we've maybe done in the past that have not been helpful or whatever it is. And this is just lessons. You know, I always think it's like lessons. Life is just lessons and experiences. And if we can just start to see what we're learning and look at our patterns, then we can start to make the right changes so that future relationships, you name that you're in a loving, trusting relationship. And I love hearing that so much. And you've had to go through all the turbulent times.
Yes. To really learn, what is good, to be able to recognize it. I think something that I just have to say is like, how good is it to be in a relationship where you feel safe enough to do so?
Yeah. Like, oh my God.
Chalk and cheese, really.
Yeah.
Because it's like you go from a relationship where you're just feeling constantly anxious. And, you know, as you've just said, it's not always the other person's fault. Like perhaps there are areas of yourself that you have to accept you're perpetuating. Like I said, if you are anxiously attached if you have an attachment style that's anxious or that's avoidant and you keep finding yourself in those similar situations, then yes, you have to do the work internally to understand where you might be perpetuating the patterns. But also another answer, and this is one answer that they often say in the literature, is in order to heal, be with someone who doesn't trigger that aspect of you as much.
You go. You go. I've got something after you.
I know. She's got a big one. That was a big one. Okay, so I just saw a massive light bulb pop up over Hattie's head. So I think essentially, like, I just know now I'm in a relationship with someone who actually is avoidant. He knows that. He did the test.
Oh, and he's Justin. Like,
oh, Juzzy.
Juzzy.
He knows that. And he said it to me, actually. We were sort of maybe like 2 or 3 months in and he said, I have to tell you something. He said it in this like big secret way because he knew I was studying psych and knew that I knew about attachment theory. I was like, blah, 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 attachment this, attachment that. Anyway, he was like, oh, I have to tell you. And he's like, I'm actually avoidant. And I didn't, I now having done so much work, and when I say so much work, I mean so much reading, I haven't taken part in research. But so much reading on it, I try not to oversubscribe to it. And we can talk about this after. But the oversubscription of something makes you like really maybe over-identify with it. So I try not to. And so when he said that to me, I remember turning to him and just going, oh, well, we should probably break up then. And like I was joking. And he really, really took it to heart. And he was like, I just shared something really vulnerable with you. How could you do that? And so like actually in the end, we had a really big conversation about it. And so he was like, I'm really trying to be aware of my triggers and what happens. And so then we started to work through, okay, well, what would a relationship look like where his needs are met, where he can reduce his triggers and where I could reduce mine? So maybe it's like, you know, an example. I mean, we do this now and it's actually really beautiful, but not necessarily just for these reasons. But, you know, things like reassurance to me through physical touch, understanding what my love language is because that helps me to feel loved, but not necessarily to need like constant reassurance. So there's a difference between like feeling safe and then someone just constantly being like, I love you, I love you, I love you, I love you, and you not really hearing it, right? And so understanding each other's love language really helped us to kind of be in a place where our triggers are reduced. So that's just what I wanted to say. It's fucking nice to be with someone that's like emotionally intelligent enough to be able to like have those conversations where I can say, hey, Justin, I'm feeling really insecure at the moment. Can we talk about it? And he's like, yeah, let's list it out. And I'm like, okay, this, this, and this. And he's like, oh, no, I meant this, this, and this. And I'm like, oh, cool. I feel at ease. Cool. Thank you for letting me like express that and release the pressure valve rather than like, you know, you go like, you know, you'll do play these stupid games and you'll go, okay, fine. Like the past Shona would be like, oh, I feel anxious. Okay, he's not replying. Okay, well, you know what? I'm going to double down and I'm not going to reply. And then, and then what I'm going to do, and this is like real old Shona behavior, then I'm just going to go reach out to some other guys I know and make sure he knows that I've spoken to these other guys and try and make him jealous. Like just ridiculous things like that that happen. And I want to normalize, like not normalize them, but if you have done this, anyone listening, where, you know, you've tried to use other people to make your partner, you know, jealous or have them express love for you, like it's a thing. I know that it happens. And, you know, I definitely have taken part in that behavior. And now I'm like, oh, you know what? I don't want that. I don't want my partner to do that to me. Yeah. I don't want to be living a life where I have to constantly try to like get love by making someone else jealous or, you know, various things like that. So yeah, sorry, I went on a tangent. You know, what was your
love tangents? No, no, no. There was so many things in that. And I'm like, oh my God. And I guess one thing I took from that, as you shared, Shona, is, and I think about this all the time, real relationships are vulnerable. In order to be vulnerable, it has to be safe enough to share.
Yeah.
And that's, I think, is a missing part for a lot of relationships where the person doesn't feel safe enough to share because the other person on the other side might take it as an attack or like, oh, you're whinging or you're such hard work. It's like, how do we not make this such hard work if we can talk to each other?
Yeah.
If we can actually express how we feel, not in a way that is put on you, but just, you know, I feel a certain way because X, Y, and Z. How do I, you know, and again, when we feel a certain way, we create a story around it. And as you said, it's like Justin's like, no, I didn't mean it like this. Or you were like, no, I didn't mean it like this. And sometimes our perception gets the perception of what we've said isn't received in the way that we wanted it to be received. And I've had to do that with my partner. It's like, oh no, I meant it like this. No, no, I didn't. I'm really, thank you so much for sharing that with me. But actually what I meant was this, but his state heard something different, right? So it wasn't what I said, but it landed differently. And I'm so grateful that my partner now, you know, he's so open to learning, like, and you know, that takes courage and vulnerability because he's had to share things with me that have been so hard for him to share because maybe he's never felt it before or, you know, and even I've had to share things where I've gone, oh my God, I'm kind of embarrassed about this, but I really need to get this off my chest. And that is what a safe relationship should and can be like when both parties are willing to go, let's expose ourselves to ourselves and let's work out what the boundaries of our relationships are and what we want it to be. And I always think to myself, okay, how would I like to be treated? Because, you know, in the past I've done behaviors that I really, as an adult now in this relationship, would never want to do again. And that means like, okay, so we have to stop ourselves. We want to go do this thing that feels safe when we feel, a breakdown down here and this thing, you know, like you said, it's like, oh, I'm going to message. You know, that you did that to keep safe and to get a reaction from over here. But was it helpful? Well, in the long term, no. In the short term, no. Actually, it's not.
Yep.
And so we have to break habits with ourselves. But we always try and do what feels safe and sometimes we got to go to discomfort and then build and then safety in a new way.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And we're really cultivating a society of like instant gratification. And so I think that, you know, there's a, I notice even when I get stressed about exams or just stressed about everything in my life, like if I feel like I'm quite overwhelmed with a bunch of tasks, my natural response is to spend more time on social media. And the reason, and more time scrolling, and the reason is because it is an instantly gratifying kind of distraction for me. I can just go open up the phone and start scrolling, and I'm kind of like, oh, this person's content. And I can just, the problem is I can justify it in my head as work. I'm like, oh, I'm checking out Hattie's, like, you know, work stuff. I'm checking
love
out Rachel's
what she shared today. It was fabulous.
Yeah, I'm like, oh, this is great. I'm just going to, you know, and I'm chatting to people and like, this is
work. Business, right?
Yeah, it's business.
Cultivating.
Totally. You know, this is productive. And I know that as I start to ramp up in my time, the time spent on there, then I know I'm like, oh, okay, let's just pause for a second and let's try and figure out where I'm probably just stressed and I need to actually get some other things done that I'm avoiding. And so similar things can happen in that. In relationships, when we start to play games with our partners, you know, if we're feeling insecure somewhere, the instant gratification will not necessarily come from you talking to your partner and dealing with your insecurities. The instant gratification comes from you playing games or from you resorting to things that might get you a quick boost in confidence, whether it's
a validation.
You know, a validation. Yeah. You know, whether it's from that ex-partner or it's that new person or it's, you know, someone that you can slid into your DMs the other day, something like that, that can make you feel a bit, and it's a band-aid for your insecurity when really what you need to do is accept that there's a wound and take it to the person that you truly care about and say like, hey, I have this wound. Can we work through it? And maybe it's, as you said, and I think you profoundly said, it's not about throwing it at your partner and saying, here, carry this wound for me. It's actually just about saying like, hey, I've got this thing and it's like hurting. Can we work through it together? I don't know how to do it. And sometimes the other thing is sometimes you'll recognize patterns in times when you feel more insecure than others. And something that I recently found with Justin actually was that I was feeling particularly insecure about our relationship when I, for a period of time, had to stop because of uni. I had to stop training and I had to stop. I was like, it was just this weird time where like I wasn't training as much. I had no goals in my training. I had no like specific thing. I wasn't doing jiu-jitsu. I wasn't doing Muay Thai. I was just doing nothing other than, you know, my study and trying to write some work stuff. And it didn't fulfill my sense of self, right? My self-identity was like really like low. And I was then seeking Justin to try to fill the hole that I felt, you know what I mean? And there's just no one can fill that gap, really, like
but yourself.
And so it was, we talked through it and he was he was a safe enough place to be able to have that conversation. But what I ultimately realized was that the problem at its core really lied in my own sense of self and that I needed to do more stuff for myself, which then interestingly, inadvertently kind of makes your partner more attracted to you because they're suddenly like, oh, damn.
She's a strong, independent woman. She going up on her
like,
own.
Look at this person like in their wholeness. Like they're so, it's so attractive, right? And actually I have a story. Esther Perel has a video on desire in long-term relationships. She's like, how do you maintain desire in a long-term relationship? And
she's
she's the best. She interviewed a whole bunch of her clients over time, over many years. And the two fundamental things that she said that helped desire in relationships, or she said, when do you feel most desired of your partner? And they responded with two things. One was when I'm not with them, which is quite funny, but sometimes distance creates obviously fondness. So like when they would go away and then come back, desire would increase.
Oh, good. Coben, you ready for me? I've been away for 2 days. Come on, baby, get ready. I'm ready for you.
he will be. And then the other thing is seeing your partner in their self-strength, right? Seeing your partner in their element, right?
So
it might be
watching
their partner interact at a party and seeing, you know, being really charming or being really enthusiastic, or maybe it's seeing them do their craft or seeing them train or whatever it might be, right? We all have those things that we look at our partner and just think like, oh, you're amazing and I love you and that's beautiful. And that helps to increase desire. Again, it's not the same as putting them on a pedestal. It's just about admiration and going, yes, you are your own person. So coming back to the story, I realized that I wasn't filling my own cup enough and it was causing me to feel insecure. And as an insecurely attached person, my default response was to actually put that on to Justin or to and I have in previous relationships gone, I don't feel good about myself. Oh, I know what will make me feel good. Reassurance from someone else that I'm lovable. So I'm going to seek it out. And so then I'm like, do you love me? Do you love me? I don't think you love me. And so then they're like, and particularly if they're avoidant, they're going to be like, can you fuck right off? In the case of Justin, thankfully, we've both been in relationships enough that we can turn around and go like, all right, let's talk. What's happening here? How can I make you feel more loved? And then we go, okay, X, Y, Z. And I'm like, he's like, okay, do you feel like I'm already doing those? I'm like, oh yeah, I do feel like you're already doing those. And then I'm like, oh, you know what? It's me.
Oh, I just love that Shona, because I get so many, every time I do a Q&A, you know, so many beautiful women reach out and they're like, how do you deal with heartbreak? Or how do you deal with not being with a partner? How do you find your soulmate? And, you know, I struggled with this. You know, I was like, oh my God, like,
There was a period where you and I were like, do we think we should just get dogs?
I know. I was like, I remember I asked Shona, can she pash me just in the daylight because I just wanted someone to kiss. She's like, what? Like now? And I'm like, yes. Just whenever I want to kiss you, like, will you pash me? Please?
Can you be designated pasher? Yeah. Pashy?
Can you be my buddy system? I'm feeling really lonely.
Anytime,
because she's such a safe person. She was my safe place. And
fuck, that was
you know, intense. And it wasn't till I just worked on, like, went away and just was like, you know what, I'm open, I'm ready to, because for a long time I was closed doors, like, don't even come near me, no one. And then I was like, I'm actually just open, but whenever. And it was when I started to just work on work and, you know, I was smashing training, so that was a lot of fulfillment. And then, you know, lo and behold, Coben came along and it was like there was no expectation actually on this thing.
I remember looking at photos of him at an FBC.
Coben, I was showing some screenshots that I'd taken of you to the girls. I hope that's okay. Manifesting. but yeah, and here we are. And so, you know, I guess what is some advice that you have for the amazing women of any age when it comes to, I guess, just having patience and trusting that everything will fall into place when it falls into place.
I mean, that's the advice. Yeah. That's definitely the takeaway. It's fucking hard though. Like when you're deep in heartbreak or deep in a feeling of like, I'm going to be honest with you, you know, self-loathing, self-rejection, you know, these are like very strong things. They're often reinforced by society and I'm not blaming society. We cannot. We've got to stop doing that and being like, can we normalize? It's like, just normalize it yourself.
Yeah.
Like you have to own it.
Self-leadership and radical responsibility. Exactly. Thank you very much.
Radical responsibility and high agency behavior. Like it's like you have the choices around this. So let's just really try to cultivate that. So I think for me, I just want to start by saying for anyone listening that's, you know, going through that and really feeling low, like, fuck, man, to Hattie and I know, like, what that feels like and how you can really just feel blinded thinking, like, I am never going to find that person. What I would say, my biggest advice, and I, you know, I'm often saying this to girlfriends around me as well, you've got to drop the narrative, because remember the expectation effect that I talked about earlier, you've got to drop the narrative that it will never happen. Because I think sometimes other than doing all the self-work and stuff like that, which you probably have been doing and you're thinking like, because this is how I was feeling. I was like, I've fucking done a lot of self-work. Okay. So like, I'm ready. Okay.
I put my name on the list of Santa and he hasn't come yet.
He hasn't come yet. What's happening? But cool also girl. The other thing is that there's only so much healing you can do single. Okay, because like the shit comes back. Let me tell you, that shit resurfaces the second you're in love or the second you start to experience romantic feelings for someone.
Oh, God, I can relate to that.
Right? It comes straight back up and you're like, oh, fuck, hello.
Oh, my God. Relationships taught me a lot. Being out of a relationship, being back in a relationship.
Being back in them. So it's not a – so I recognize that frustration of like, yeah, hun, I've done the work on myself single. Can I just find a motherfucker to test this shit on, please? Right? Like you're like, where is this man or woman? So I get it. So all I can say is if you have a narrative running through your mind that's like, I'm never going to find him or whoever I find is going to be bad or, you know, whatever, all men are trash, whatever it might be, drop the narrative and work on dropping that narrative and being open to receiving a different story because, and I'm not just saying this from an new age perspective or an airy fairy perspective, and by the way, I love airy fairy shit. So does Hattie. So like, we love that shit. But I also love empirical methods and I love science
and reality.
And so we know now through the expectation effect that, you know, what you truly believe is going to have this self-fulfilling prophecy. So what may start to happen is that if you truly believe that all men are trash, the likelihood of you meeting men that are trash or you finding, having a lens that perceives men in that way, there's a really big possibility that that's going to keep coming back to you.
I also think it just lessens the opportunity of someone really lovely to come along.
Exactly.
Because like, that's the only lens that you see. It's like,
yeah, and that might cause you to have certain characteristics yourself. So you might be quite standoffish. And so the only man that you start to attract, oh, this is big for me, actually, this is a big realization. I had hyper independence. I had hyper, like, I had built a wall so fucking big, bigger than Trump's fucking wall that he was going to build across fucking Mexico. Right? Okay. This was more impenetrable than that one. And this wall was covered in like friendliness. So it was a bit like, oh, well, this girl's nice. She's going to take care of it. This is so beautiful. And instead, I was just like, no, I can pay myself. Pack my bags, thank you. I would pay for, like, so boyfriends, you know, ex-boyfriends, ex-partners, whatever, have come to me and said, like, it was really hard to feel that I could give because anytime there was an opportunity for me to give and share and express love for you, you'd be like, no, it's cool, I can take care of it. So I would pay. I would, you know, take them on holidays. I would do all these things that would stop them from even being able to give. And let's face it, we express our love through giving in some way, giving an energy, whether it's affection, whether it's money, whether it, whatever it might be. It's some kind of act, right? And it's a giving sense. And so, yeah, I was blocking that shit right up. And so what happened was I met men that were very much about trying to bulldoze, basically either needed really big taking, really mothering so that they really needed me to mother them, or they were just like not very nice men at all, like really wanted to try to like conquer me. Yeah. So those two qualities in anyone, whether it's a man or a woman, is not great or any gender spectrum, right? Not great. So if someone either needs to be mothered, probably not like the greatest of relationships because they're just going to constantly feel like, okay, now it's turned to look after me and they're like, what, mom, huh? Right? Or if it's the type that wants to try and conquer you, again, that's not really a nice safe base for a relationship if someone's like trying to just like conquer you.
I think, and again, this is just my own opinion, but I think there are some women that conquering makes them feel like they're needed. And that's a difference between actual love and the feeling of being needed instead of, you know.
Fuck, dude, that was big for me on the mothership side. Like I felt like if I could mother them, then they needed me. The mothership.
Yeah.
I was the mothership. No, I really felt like that was like a codependence thing where it was like if I could create an environment where they really needed me because I was technically their mother, then they would never leave and I would reign supreme.
Isn't that evil laugh?
God, I'm not that evil, but it's like that was how I was trying to access this quote unquote safety, right? Which we just keep, that's the theme.
Yeah. And I guess like, you know, for all of us, like I'm always curious about myself and why I behave the way I behave and how I feel the way I feel and all this kind of stuff. And it's like really tuning in and go, well, what is, because relationships are always two. We can't just blame the other person. No. But we also can't just blame ourselves. It's like, all right, what are we doing in both parties?
Yep.
And then how do we start to kind of shift either how we behave or what we look for? And I guess, you know, I always think about relational rhythms. And something you were speaking about before and it made me go, is because Michelle, I remember her telling me that relationship trauma can only be healed in relationship.
Dude, this is and huge. That's,
you know, because I kept trying to do this stuff on my own. She's like, you're going to heal. It's going to be. Yep. And I remember just going, so relationship trauma can only be healed in relationship. So here we are. You know? And it's like, you're ready?
Let's hold hands.
We're in it together. Oh, you know, but that in a way is like so also, that's the repair system, you know. And so again, Michelle's always taught me it's the repair system with others and with ourselves. And that's what makes me go, this person knows, like, it's all about a repair system. And I always think no matter what breakdown we have, we're actually going to be okay. Because yeah. love is there and love is open and love can I feel, it's like love can be flexible. It's like it's learning. Like it really is. She's powerful in the way that she learns. And I can still love unconditionally, but unconditional love still has boundaries.
Yeah, that's a big one.
That's what we have to think about. Yeah.
Yeah, that's a really big one, I think, for sure.
Something that we haven't touched on, and I want to end with this, Shona Virtue, otherwise we will talk for hours. And I would love to talk for hours.
Yeah, go.
We haven't touched much on what you actually do in terms of your virtue method. Oh, you haven't mentioned that once. And ladies, Shona has helped women from all over the world. I've watched it, her journey through social media. I'm actually going to get my mum onto your mobility sequence because she has really stiff wrists. Yay. And, you know, you're doing so much amazing stuff in the world. You've written a book. Can we talk a little bit about your professional life, your workspace?
Yes, we totally can. So the virtue method, big part of my life. It's essentially
– So is attachment theory.
Virtue method is a big part. It's basically like kind of the culmination, I guess. It was like this climax of like everything that – it came about as this culmination of my experience as a gymnast, a yoga teacher and a personal trainer, really. Like kind of combining all of those elements. And I mean, you come from this background too, right? Gymnastics, it's like strength and flexibility and elegance because it's like this sort of dance element to it as well. And so I really wanted to bring all of that together. And what I found, particularly working as a trainer, was that we tend to gravitate towards what we love, but the body is a bit different. Like it needs balance in things. So if we just always do what we like, often we're neglecting certain areas. And so I found that a lot of people that were strong often weren't mobile, or at least people that were really into like weight training or running or the things that were a bit more yang energy, a bit active. Yeah. They lacked like flexibility. They lacked meditational abilities to relax and vice versa. And so obviously being a yoga teacher for a very long time, over 12 years now, same thing. Yogis, so much flexibility, so much isometric strength. You could argue that for sure. But then they just really lacked a lot of other things. They lacked strength. They lacked fitness. They lacked, they might be able to like get into the splits but couldn't do a pull-up, for example. I mean, lots of people can't do pull-ups. But anyway, that might not be the pinnacle of your desire for health and fitness. But essentially it was just like I saw all these gaps. And so I wanted to create something that people could come to that was a combination of the both. And so in the training and in the programming, there's always equal parts of both. We do everything. And it was sort of like creating a one-stop shop for strength and mobility and meditation. And now with the psychology degree, I want to then paint it all over with what I know about behavior.
Amazing.
And so that's all starting to feed through. So I have home workout programs, which were really beneficial for people during COVID.
Amazing.
Which gave them a program to follow, all real-time videos. So essentially you're kind of like, you just hit play and then you work out with me at the same time. And then I have a mobility program because mobility is really important as well. And I have a yoga program now too for those people that want to dive into it. So yeah, Virtue Method was really just a combination of my experience coming together.
Amazing. And I'm going to wrap this one up because I'm looking at the time and I'm loving this, but where can people find you, Shona?
You can find me on probably Instagram. It's probably the easiest. Instagram, Shona_virtue. And you can also find me on YouTube. If you want to take part in some of my workouts or my yoga sequences, then just head to YouTube. They're all free, obviously, as YouTube is. And that's just Shona Virtue.
And your book?
And my book, yes. My book, you can just get it online or in bookstores. And I wrote that in 2016, but it's kind of like the Bible of everything. So it has like information on food as well. And it was actually co-written, or at least I had it checked over. I wrote it all, but it was checked over by a sports dietitian because I really wanted to make sure that all the food stuff in there was correct and applicable. So she looked over that and she looked over the meal plan that was in there and understanding calories and macros and micros.
Yeah. Amazing. Well, Shona, today was incredible. Like I said, I would keep talking to you for hours.
Me too.
This is what I wanted our conversation to be like, you know, something that you and I would pretty much go sit down and talk to in a coffee shop, but now is exposed to thousands of women here and men. Guys, if you want to reach out to Shona, she's the friendliest person ever. Head to her IG or check her out on her website or get her book. And thanks everyone for tuning in.
Thank you.
The Hattie Boydell podcast is powered by Gut Performance, my daily non-negotiable for a happy and healthy gut. Head to gutperformance.com.au and use the word Hattie for a discount.